Hello and welcome to the On The Money series, where we'll look at the issues surrounding financial elder abuse. On The Money is broadcast over the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Now we bring you our first instalment of Money Dearest. Hello, I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to Money Dearest. Money Dearest is a podcast series focusing on the growing concern of elder abuse and is brought to you by the Sydney Community Foundation, the Perkins Family Foundation, and 2SERFM. In this podcast, we're going to look at the broad continuum of abuse in discussion with Kay Papadopoulos, Senior Solicitor at the New South Wales Trustee and Guardian's Office, Carolyn Smith from the Supported Decision-Making Team at the New South Wales Public Guardian, and Michael Perkins, Special Counsel for the Nexus Law Group. Kay Papadopoulos, we often think of abuse in terms of physical abuse, but there's quite a few ways in which people can be abused. Could you explain how they differ?
There are multiple different types of abuse, and it's important to note that more than one can be perpetrated at a time. And some types of abuse are also criminal offences. So types of abuse include financial abuse, which is using someone's money, property or other assets illegally or improperly, or forcing them to change their will or sign documents. We understand this is one of the most common form of abuse seen. There's also other types as well. So there's social abuse, which can be forcing someone to become isolated by restricting their access to others, including family, friends or services. And in a way, this can also be used to prevent other people from finding out about the abuse. Another type of abuse is emotional or psychological abuse. So that includes things like using threats, humiliation or harassment, which can cause distress and feelings of shame, stress or powerlessness. And we find that that type of abuse often occurs in combination with other forms of abuse. There's also physical abuse, so that could be inflicting pain or injury on someone by hitting, slapping, pushing, or also using restraints. Another form of abuse is neglect, so that's failing to provide the basic necessities of life, and it's interesting to note that that can be either intentional or unintentional. And there's also sexual abuse, which is sexual activity for which the person has not consented. So you can see there that there's a broad variety of types of abuses that can be perpetrated against someone.
Yes, and Michael Perkins, you've been involved many years with people in the state planning and as a solicitor in the area. What are some of the things that happens when it comes to you that's gone too far?
The first question I get, and indeed had in a phone call with a new client this morning, saying, my husband who has a brain injury has just done this, do I have a right to intervene? So I think it's important for people to understand that they do have rights to intervene. We do have a Age Discrimination Commissioner now in New South Wales that has got powers of investigation. So if people are concerned, concern is a sufficient cause to trigger a report now. And I think it's very important that people understand that it's not, you can do more than just call a helpline. And so that's generally the first point of contact. The second thing is that we've got to be careful to make sure that any response to concern is actually appropriate. And indeed, in the conversation that I had this morning, it was a matter of saying, look, I think the first thing we need to understand is why has this conduct occurred? What is the purpose of it? What is the intention behind it? Because we might be having the right thing done for the wrong reasons or the wrong way. We need to understand first the context for the conduct that's causing the concern. Then we can worry about how we deal with responses. And this is where I think the new commissioner can provide a very good service in terms of early intervention. And I think the key message here that we need to put is don't wait for the wheels to fall off the family truck. If you are concerned, if you see someone's situation deteriorating, it is time to stand up and do something. You know, it's too late when the damage is done. It's what we want to try and encourage people to do with the new commissioner is get involved early.
And one of the things, Carolyn Smith, when we're getting involved, it can be not just about the finances of a person, it can be about the care of a person. And that's where jobs come to you in terms of the guardianship, where you have to take over the decision-making for people. Yeah. Give us a bit of an idea of how that happened.
Sometimes when the situations have got to a point where the person can't make the decision for themselves anymore because they've been deemed unable and they are in a situation where they might need protection from abuse, we, the public guardian, may be appointed with health and welfare functions. So things like accommodation where someone might live, the services that they might need, the doctors that they might need to see, or the medication that they might need to have. We are appointed at the absolute end of the line. We are the last resort because we are a government agency who is stepping in. And essentially, because the person can't uphold their own decision-making rights, we have to uphold them for them. So it's quite stressful for everyone involved and often quite traumatic situations where there is family dysfunction, where we have to step in and really try to get to know the person in crisis or in difficult circumstances and then make decisions, hopefully decisions that they would have made for themselves, but sometimes not if there is if they're at risk of abuse or harm.
And of course the other side of it, Kay, is the financial side or the legal side perhaps. It's when documents need to be signed, when money needs to be transferred or someone needs to take over the running of someone's affairs. How do you find it when people come to you? What are the sort of things that are the main areas of contention?
So if we're appointed financial manager and we're making financial decisions for them, some common areas of concern that we look at are, for example, where there have been unexplained transactions, for example, large bank withdrawals before that. There might be significant changes to a will. There might be unexplained disappearance of belongings or transfer of assets from that person's name.
Jewellery and things.
Yeah. Well, also you find real property. I mean, you might have an investment property, which, you know, in the current property market is not insignificant, being transferred into somebody else's name for below market consideration or nil, you know, no funds. They might have an inability to pay bills or access their bank accounts, etc. So they're the sorts of things that, you know, we do look at.
And so, Michael Perkins, this is probably a result of family dysfunction and when people aren't operating in the way that is in the best interests of their family member. And what are the sort of things you've found in your practice when it's come to your to stage where you are needed?
Luckily, most of the times it's at the proposal stage and people coming in saying, is this possible? Can we do it? Occasionally, it is a discovery problem that someone comes in and says, oh, no, this has been done. Can we remediate it? Inevitably, any of these problems come because of financial stress in families. That is the big trigger. And I think that the problem is generally generated because the person who is being abused, for whatever reason, does not have the ability to speak up for themselves. So when we're looking at saying, well, okay, what do we do? The first thing we have to try and do is work out who can speak for the person concerned. It is early days for the Disability Commissioner in New South Wales. I think they will be a tool to help us deal with this because from a legal point of view, we have a problem. We have a legal system that is focused on substitute decision making. So once someone gives a power of attorney, they give enormous scope for someone to use their property and potentially benefit themselves. So what can you do to stop this? Well, at the moment, it's all about family education and trying to get families to have a straightforward plan for how they're going to care and for the person concerned, and what resources are going to be used to support that. families for years have been making loans to one another and helping each other out. You can't necessarily say just because someone needs help, it should not be given. The issue is, how does that decision or proposal sit in relation to the overall welfare, care and needs of the older person? The proposals that exist in the New South Wales government at the moment to change the Guardianship Act and bring in a more formal system of recognising supported decision-making is, I think, a good thing, but it has a large impact on how people approach these problems. So what we come back to is a need to understand how we can best educate families to row in the same boat. That public education is, I think, our most immediate challenge. And from our point of view as lawyers, we find that we're using our alternate dispute resolution and skills as the first point of trying to respond to these issues, not just running off to court straight away, because that will always be the most disruptive, alienating, disempowering solution. So we try and land people in a softer place where relationships can be remediated, and the person's interest, who is under care, who is of diminished capacity for whatever reason, is going to have a fair voice in whatever is happening.
You're listening to the Money Dearest podcast. I'm Roderick Chambers, and I'm here with Kay Papadopoulos from the New South Wales Trustee and Guardian, Carolyn Smith from the Office of the New South Wales Public Guardian, and Michael Perkins, Special Counsel from the Nexus Law Group. New South Wales is currently looking at moving to a new approach, which has been introduced in Victoria, by focusing on what is someone's will and preference rather than just taking over a person's affairs in their best interests, a sort of more paternalistic view. But Kay, could this make it more difficult for people in your role at the New South Wales Trustee's Office, as you're the last resort and you must take over a person's affairs?
It certainly will. Having said that, though, there's generally times where I do try and call the client to find out their views on something, but if the new changes come in, that will definitely have a huge implication.
Because this has already happened in Victoria, hasn't it? And we've got some idea of what may happen, but nevertheless, the legislation, we don't know what it's going to be like, so we're not sure. I guess we're in this panel here, we're trying to look at the ways in which people should respond to this. And Carolyn, the way that we move to this, one of the ways that has really gained some great currency is to get supported decision making in when there is some cognitive decline, when there is some decline in the individual.
Yeah, so there is a really big push, not just in New South Wales, but nationally and across the world, really, that relates back to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, that says that we should be doing everything from a person-centred practice. Everyone has human rights and everyone should be able to access those human rights. And some people are going to need extra support to access those rights. And that trickles all the way down to our agency at Trustee and Guardian and the Public Guardian, where we currently make decisions in someone's best interests. Now, of course, we will seek the views of the person where we can, but we're not bound by those views. And this significant shift that is coming, and as you said, Victoria has changed their guardianship legislation that'll be coming into effect in March 2020. So they will be the test case, if you like, in Australia and as to how this is going to work in a substitute space. But in the meantime, in New South Wales and other states across Australia, we are trying to push the boundaries around doing supported decision making, which is essentially saying everyone should be given as much support as possible so that they can make as many decisions for themselves that they can. And that's a real flip from saying I'm going to make a decision that I think is best for the person, because I could potentially have a conflict of interest. I might unduly influence that person because I really do think that it's better that they live in an aged care facility rather than at home, because they might fall over at home and hurt themselves. And that's going to make me feel good. But how's it going to make the person feel who's lived in that house for 70 years and they don't want to go? So we really need to ask that person, what do you want and how can we make it happen for you? What support do you need in order for us to give you the life that you choose?
And there's sort of some moves towards that area with the increase in home care facilities and ageing in place and that sort of thing. So we're sort of moving in that direction, but there's going to be a lot more required, isn't there?
Yeah, so we are. So governments are working towards having stronger communities. We're part of the new Stronger Communities cluster. There's a new aged care charter. There's new aged care standards. The Royal Commission into Aged Care and Disability is going to be helping us in this space. So we are all moving towards a person-centred approach. And it is quite a challenge for a lot of us because it requires us to take time to hear the person, to get to know the person. And that is significant resources. That's what it comes down to. But it's also about community. We can't, this isn't just government, it isn't just private, it's everyone. We all have to get better at this because we are all heading in the same direction. We have an ageing population. We are going to be part of that aged, and we all want to work together to make sure that we're living the life that we all want when we get to that position.
Because Michael Perkins, we actually sort of know the sorts of things that do go wrong, don't we? There's a lot of knowns, yeah. But it's we haven't really been supporting people, have we, in the past?
No, I think just like there's a myth in the law called the reasonable man, I think there's also a myth in the law called the competent client. And I think that as lawyers, we have relied on the assumption of capacity, and I think rightfully so for a long period. But the reality of the society that we have is that we have a significant cohort in the society of increasing longevity but declining ability. We haven't had that as a social reality in our communities before, but it's well and truly in front of us now. So I think the starting point is to stop. And don't forget, this is me as the lawyer talking. Stop thinking of supported decision-making as a legal solution and start thinking of supported decision-making as a methodology for advice or care. Supported decision-making is an approach to being focused on the voice of the person concerned. So if we start looking at that as a professional skill, we can start baking supported decision-making into day-to-day interactions with professionals, with people in business, with people that have got front-end contact with customers like bank staff, and starting to focus employers on saying, hey, we need to get listening skills in the workforce, not telling skills. People are sick and tired of being told. And I think one of the interesting sidelights from the Hayne Royal Commission is that we finally have had some admissions that compliance in financial services was all about disclosure being sufficient because everyone had the ability to read, understand, and respond to it. That's the very thing that's undermined by cognitive decline. So what is, as we say, the best interest of the client? Well, we can no longer assume that they can necessarily process the information we give them. So I think the biggest question we have in the community now is how do we do informed consent better?
Yes, Carolyn, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I just want to also make clear that ability is on a spectrum, decision-making ability particularly, it's on a spectrum. And so depending on the decision, depending on the context, there will be lots of different things that impact and affect someone's ability. If they're really stressed, they're going to slide further down that decision-making spectrum. So we've got to get that balance right in the supported space, because at the essence of supported decision-making is where we can, it's building the capability or the capacity of the person. And if they can't be built because of cognitive decline, for example, then how can we build those supports around them? Might be in the form of people or technology or even attitudinal, that we're able to keep them more autonomous.
Kay, like you and Carolyn are seeing people in crisis at sort of the very end,
yes,
of a process. When thinking about will and preference and how we're going to help people make decisions and so forth, do you often find that people haven't got a will? physical will.
So, yes, I do find that, yes.
And that's really a bit of a problem, isn't it? Because they haven't ever thought about, in when they were cognitively better off, how they want things to be when they're not no longer around.
That's right. In the absence of that, then there's legislation that sets out where their assets go that can cause any number of issues. So, you know, at least if they'd done a will when they were able to, then they would have had the opportunity to really sit down and think about who they'd like to get what.
And that sort of gives a bit of a basis. And also, if the family is aware of what has been decided, then there's less areas for dispute, there's less areas for people to feel aggrieved and that they should perhaps have something that they shouldn't have.
So in terms of a will, obviously that only comes in after somebody's passed away. So
yes,
there's lots of disputes we see after somebody's passed away in terms of what people felt they should have received and didn't. We also see arguments while the person is alive as well, and under financial management, you know, it often comes out to pass that we see that sums of money have been moved, or there might be a family member living in the property with the person rent-free. Other family members are not happy with that situation and want them removed.
And if there are people within the family group that would be competent to perform functions for that person, whether it be their parent or another relative, then they should really put it down in writing, shouldn't they? They should have a power of attorney in place ready for the time that they need it, because you can't do it at another time, can you?
So you can do a power of attorney whilst you have capacity.
Yes.
So I would recommend that you do a power of attorney when you have capacity and you really turn your mind to any number of situations that might occur. So, for example, even somebody in their 30s or 40s might like to have a think about, you know, if a property is in one partner's name, if they were still alive but, say, for example, had lost capacity, had to go into a nursing home, do they want the property to be sold and another property purchased in their sole name and to allow certain people to live in it? Do they want their funds to be able to be expended, you know, on their care at home? Do they have children that they want to be allowed to access funds? You know, I've had people put in parameters. For example, if my child's under 25, then they're allowed up to X dollars per year for the payment of school fees or university fees, etc. So they're really sitting down and having a think about it.
And I didn't want to leave this area of documentation until we also mentioned a guardianship or an advance care directive, Carolyn.
Sure.
Because when you're asked that question, under stress, in a hospital, yes, we can do an operation. It has a percentage of success. It's a very hard decision, isn't it?
Very hard decision, particularly when the person who is having the operation can't provide their own consent. So preferable if someone has taken the time and thought to put in place an enduring guardianship document, which essentially chooses people that you trust and that know you really well to make decisions for you if you can't in the future in those health and lifestyle areas. And then the extension of that is the advanced care directive. So that relates to specific care and treatment towards the end of life. So what you do and don't want, and that really should be a living document, because that can change depending on your health needs. But the thing that...
But there might be some specific things as well. Someone might say, I do not want to be put on one of those heart-lung machines.
Absolutely.
They might say I don't want penicillin if I get... They might say that, and they should put those in the document,
shouldn't they? Absolutely put those things into the document, make it really clear, because really what you're doing there, you're taking the burden, for want of a better term, away from your loved ones, because you're making the decision.
Correct.
It's still your voice. And everyone is looking for what you would have wanted in that situation. So if you've taken the time out to clearly document in an advance care directive in that particular case, they can go straight to that document and say, this is what this person wants. She doesn't want the extra chemo, or she doesn't want the antibiotics. And so we don't need to do that.
And it stops the family conflict as well. You know, my mother would have been alive today if my elder brother hadn't have allowed that operation to go ahead.
It's a traumatic...
Things like that.
Yeah. It's a traumatic enough situation.
Yeah.
For anyone, and emotional for families, and everyone in that situation wants to be focused on the one thing and the one person, and that's the care and the love that they need at that time, not the nitty-gritty about which medication they should or shouldn't have. Yeah. That can keep families together.
I've seen people even put in things like, you know, if I've got third-degree burns to X% of my body, I don't want life prolonging treatment. and that was not imminent. They've really just sat down and had to think about what they do or don't want. You know, if I have to have certain limbs amputated, I don't want that to go ahead. You know, so that way it's there in black and white.
Yeah, and often people know these things, don't they, Michael?
Well, they do, but I think there's also something to think about. When you're coming into this area of medical treatment and guardianship and healthcare decisions, don't forget your GP. Because if you get an advanced care planning document, and there are plenty of templates around, Department of Health issued them, the College of General Practitioners, everyone's got a template. But if you go and sit down with your GP, Medicare is contributing. So you'll probably get the most effective completion of that advanced healthcare document in conjunction with your GP. And then if the GP's got questions and concerns about legal matters or other matters, then it can be escalated. So I think, you know, this is just an example of how we need to build better cooperation across professional boundaries. And the starting point for the in the community is for the simplest entry point. And I think on this issue of advanced care planning and writing it down and getting it clear, talking to your GP first is probably the best point to start.
That's all we've got for you on Money Dearest for this podcast. I'd like to thank our panel, Kay Papadopoulos, Senior Solicitor at the New South Wales Trustee and Guardian, Carolyn Smith from the Supported Decision-Making Team at the New South Wales Public Guardian, and Michael Perkins, Special Counsel of the Nexus Law Group. Money Dearest is a podcast series focusing on financial elder abuse and is brought to you by the Sydney Community Foundation, the Perkins Family Foundation, and 2SERFM. Music for the series is by Kat Alchin and Poddington Bear. We'll be looking at various types of elder abuse situations in upcoming podcasts, so do listen in to our next instalment. I'm Roderick Chambers. Thanks for listening.